Welcome to Her Majesty's Top Gun. Sitting alone at night, strapped into a little single-seat jet fighter, above the tempestuous and freezing South Atlantic Sea, not so far from Cape Horn, and awaiting the arrival of enemy fighter aircraft, was a novel experience. It was the early hours of the 1st of May 1982, and hostilities had broken out between the UK and Argentina after the latter invaded first South Georgia and then the Falkland Islands. Above me shone a million stars, and below, parts of East Falkland and Port Stanley Town were obscured by cloud. My ship, HMS Invincible, was about 100 miles away to the east. All I could hear was the gentle whine of the aircraft's avionic systems and my steady breathing through the oxygen mask. It was a moment that I had always dreamed about, being airborne and ready for combat. As I searched the dark skies to the west on my radar, I reflected with some amusement on the last words I had heard on deck before I closed my canopy ready for launch. It was a Freudian slip from my squadron's exceptional air engineer officer, Dick Goodenough. "Goodbye, boss." I had no fear of combat by day or night. I was ready. My only desire was to put my 15 years of training for war into successful practice. My squadron was ready to wreak havoc with the enemy. The tension throughout the fleet was electric. It didn't bother me at all that I might have to engage enemy fighters in combat by night to protect the Vulcan mission. The carrier battle group was completely darkened, that is to say, no lights anywhere. I descended to very low level over the uninviting sea to hide my position and that of Invincible from enemy land-based radars and cruised in 70 nautical miles to where I hoped the ship would be, one of about 40 battle group contacts on my little radar screen. My navigation computer was working perfectly, and I was relying on my captain, J.J. Black, to ensure that Invincible was precisely where he promised it would be. And he always got it right. Having selected the contact that I hoped was Invincible, I used my radar to set up a silent approach to landing. Prior to hostilities, night deck landings had already become routine for my squadron pilots, with the ship's deck and superstructure well lit. Now, 8,000 miles from home, where my family was fast asleep, there was nothing but blackness ahead of me as I descended down the glide slope at 160 knots. The aircraft was buffeting gently in the turbulent wind, but not enough to be a problem. At a quarter of a mile to go to the ship, I lowered my nozzles to the hover stop and called, "Lights!" Bingo! The dimly lit outline of the deck and the superstructure filled my windscreen. I came to the hover alongside the ship, moved sideways over the deck, and put the Sea Harrier safely down on board. But there was no time to relax. My squadron pilots were all well prepared for the long day ahead, and in the daylight hours that followed, we were on constant air patrol, stamping our authority over the Argentine fighter and fighter bomber aircraft in successful air combat. The first kill of the war was not long in coming. Deterrence and our proven combat expertise ruled the skies over the islands. On cessation of hostilities, the Battle of Britain Association sent my squadron the following signal. From the few to the very few, congratulations on a job well done. Having put my all into learning from my air warfare instructor predecessors, many of whom sacrificed their lives at sea earning the Queen's shilling, and whose legacy of defending the nation merits deep respect, I wish to pay tribute to that legacy by separating fact from fiction and recording below how and why our naval service has been allowed to decline to its present parlous state. Enjoy.